This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. This is indeed Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, Pope Jude, Pontiff of the Pick Four, with you once again on this Trainer Talk program, and happy to have everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM Channel 206, and all of you tuning in worldwide with our live streaming at horseracingradio.net. And don't forget, you can access that streaming on your computer, your smartphone, or your mobile device, all there, horseracingradio.net. JT, happy to have you on board again, my friend.
Oh, yeah, we've been looking forward to this for a long time.
We have been. A very special show for you here this evening. And one of the great things about Trainer Talk over the past several years is we've had the opportunity to sit down with so many of the legendary trainers in the sport today. And that's certainly the case tonight as we visit with the native of Antigo, Wisconsin, which, if you're not familiar with Antigo, it is about 1.5 hours northwest of Green Bay. It boasts a population of roughly 8,200 persons. And to date, our special guest has saddled more than 4,700 winners. And those runners have earned more than $274 million in purses. Think about that. He holds the record for most wins in Triple Crown races with 14. He has saddled 20 Breeders' Cup winners. He has been honored with 5 Eclipse Awards, including the Eclipse Award of Merit, and he was inducted into Horse Racing's Hall of Fame in 1999. We welcome to the program tonight Mr. D-Wayne Lucas. Wayne, welcome to the show, my friend.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you.
You know, when you think about those numbers, you hear me run through that resume, so to speak. What's going through your mind when you're hearing those numbers?
Well, a friend of mine the other day, I was complaining, not really complaining, but kind of distraught about maybe not winning as much as I'd like to up here at Saratoga. And in my house, I've got the memorabilia that you talked about, some of the Eclipse Awards and the trophies and so forth, and they're displayed down there, and he's been there. And so he just looked at me and said, Wayne, go down to the basement and stand for an hour. You'll be fine. That's pretty much it, too. It's good to hear those, but hopefully it's not over yet. We're still pushing along pretty good.
Well, they say when you don't know where to start, you go back to the beginning. So how does a kid from a rural town in Wisconsin, which I think is more well-known for farming and lumber, if I'm not mistaken.
No, potatoes.
Potatoes?
Yeah.
Really? Well,
yeah.
How does a kid from a potato town grow up to be legendary horse trainer D-Wayne Lucas?
I don't know either how that all happened, but I know I escaped. You know, it's only 8,000 people. I don't think it's 8,000 people anymore. We never had a chance to grow because every time somebody got pregnant, another man left town. So but here's the deal. It's a pretty horse-orientated little town, and we started out there, and of course, one of my dear friends, Clyde Rice, grew up just a half mile down the road, too. And, you know, the Rice family's done so well in racing also. But we were able to get, all of us had a pony, and we run them down the side roads. And then once a year, we had the Langlade County Fair, and they would run little races there. They ran them. None of the horses were registered, and none of them were thoroughbreds probably either. But they had 14 hands and under races and 14 hands and over and then the different distances. And we ran them, and, of course, you get the bug. And from that, we kept trying to get a little better, a little better, a little better, and pretty soon we had some pretty nice horses.
Well, you were a high school teacher and a coach, and you used to spend your summers taking horses all over the country. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, The thing about it was, once you get the bug, and you want to run horses, we'd go to all the county fairs up there and everything. But my mother said, you can't fool with these horses. You got to make some contribution to society. You got to do something worthwhile in life. And so she said it was imperative that I get an education. Well, the second love was athletics. And so I was fortunate enough to go to the University of Wisconsin and graduate with a master's degree from there. And so from that, I tried to fulfill her wishes and get an education, which was almost, I got an education, I guess. Had a lot of fun. But the thing about it was the summers lent themselves to running horses. And so we started running around and traveling a little bit and getting a little bit broader in our scope of where we went and so forth. We ended up in Iowa and Park Jefferson, South Dakota, and Burwell, Nebraska, and Lincoln, Nebraska, and started expanding out a little bit further. But the beautiful part was we could do it in the summer, and then I could go back to coaching in the winter.
So the seasons had a lot to do with it, and school had a lot to do with it. When did you finally make the transition from a part-time hobbyist-type trainer to the real thing?
Well, I started to realize that probably it was going to be difficult to give up in the fall the horse racing. It was getting good. We were starting to win races. We won races, and we won them pretty regular in the summer. So now September rolls around. I got to get back to the classroom, and some of the better races are still being run in the fall, and I had to give it up, or at least not give up training, but I had to bring the horses home and get back in the classroom. So I started analyzing the salary scale. And the thing that bothered me the most was that the way the educational salaries were set up didn't let you advance for any kind of excellence. You took number of years of education, number of years of experience, run them together, that was it. Everybody got the same. That bothered the hell out of me, frankly, because I thought I was doing a better job than the guy sleeping in his classroom down the hall. So what we did is we started analyzing, can we make a living running horses? And a dear friend of mine, Jack Brainerd, up there in Rochester, Minnesota, and I sat down one night, and he said, you really would like to do it full-time, would you? And I said, do you think I can make a living at it? And I'm giving up a pretty good teaching career now, retirement, you know, health benefits, all the usual. And he said, I think you'll do just fine. So I said, you know what, I think I'm going to resign. And what I did is I resigned. And then, damn it, two kids that were coming back, two, had a terrible team. Two kids come back, sat down in the living room and talked me out of it the first year. They thought I was letting them down. They got to my heart, and I coached one more year. The next time I resigned, I just got up and got out of town.
Well, was that when you were coaching at La Crosse?
Yeah, then La Crosse Logan High School.
Yeah. When you walk through your barn area, and we're sitting here in your office here at Saratoga, as you referenced as we came on the air, you walk through your shed row, and Wayne, it is immaculate. And you've always been very meticulous in your approach to training horses and with all of your help that's involved. Was that your same approach that you took when you were coaching and teaching?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, very much so. I always thought that if you're going to spend that many hours in some facility, whether it be the locker room or the barn, that it had to be a special place. We took over a defunct locker room at La Crosse Logan High School, and we made it a clubhouse. We carpeted it with red carpeting. We had softback furniture. We let the kids come in and play the Beatles music. And everybody that was on the team had a key and could, instead of going to study hall, which was then mandatory, they could go to the locker room and study and hang out and read magazines and so forth. So it made it really special to be a player. And then the other thing we did, we raised money and we put everybody into blazers and ties. And that was unheard of in the 60s in Wisconsin.
Wow.
Everybody had to have a blazer and a tie. None of them could tie it. So we taught them how to tie their tie. And then we got rid of the yellow school bus. I said, we're first-class operation, and nobody goes in a yellow school bus. The Board of Education said, we can't afford. I said, don't worry about it. We started fundraisers in the town of La Crosse, got us some money, and we went Greyhound everywhere we went, first class all the way.
Where did that discipline come from? Was it your parents?
Pretty much, yeah. I think my dad instilled that a lot in me. And, of course, my son Jeff, you know, followed. He had a lot of discipline. I don't know if it's in the gene pool or the way we were raised, but we really had a lot of discipline. We even had these kids didn't know how to tie their tie. Many of them, you know, didn't even have a sport coat, which we furnished, of course. So I had the Hostess from the Holiday Inn come up, and we set up the library with table settings and all the tables, four to a table, and she showed them that, you know, the salad fork is the farthest one out to the right, and the spoon up on top is the soup spoon, and we would go, and we never let the players eat at a full table, you know, 8, 10, 15 guys all in one big table. They sat four to a table, they ordered off the menu, and nobody moved unless they caught my eye.
It's a hallmark of your organization, and it's been like that since you, I remember the first time you set up at Santa Anita in your barn with the white iron lawn chairs and the green grass and the flowers, and everybody goes, who the heck is this guy? What's he? Is he a gardener or a horse trainer, right? And it wasn't long before everybody, you changed the face of the backside, because pretty soon everybody's planting flowers and everybody's got, you know, something. They couldn't let Wayne, you know, be the only guy that had a decorated barn. The rest of the barn area looked like, you know, just an old dust bowl.
Willard Proctor, good dear friend on through the years, when I first came over there, he rode up on his saddle horse, and they tell this story on him. That he said, well, I don't know about this guy from the quarter horse game, but I don't know if he can train a horse, but he sure can garden. they ask Henry Marino, when we came over from Los Alamitos with the quarter horses, they asked Henry Marino, they said, what about this guy? And Henry looked at him and said, everybody's going to get up a little bit earlier from now on.
That's right.
Well, that's the thing. You have to get up pretty early in the morning to beat Dwayne Lucas to the barn. I think you're typically here, what, right around 4:30? Is that right?
A little earlier, maybe. 4:10. I try to get here right around 4, but, you know, I get that coffee cup. And I haven't changed that. I'm 81 now, and I like to get up and get started. Of course, my whole life is tied up here in this, and I don't say that boastfully. It's just a matter of fact that everything that I enjoy the most is tied up right here to this barn.
Well, a lot of times on the West Coast, people say, oh, well, he gets here so early because he has horses on the East Coast. They kind of diminish that, you know, but you're still getting up early, even though you're basically an East Coast trainer now.
Yeah, for sure.
And it hasn't changed a bit.
As a coach, you have to be a good motivator. Similar with training horses in some respects?
Maybe, yes. I think the biggest thing, Mike, has changed is being attention to detail. I think that if you can read your athletes, I think the great coaches, and I've been around some great coaches, some of my dearest friends, Bill Parcells, Bob Knight, Coach K, you know, some of these guys, Tony La Russa, these are my close friends in coaching, the late Bo Schembechler, but and I'm not just throwing out names here. These guys influenced me too. But I think the good coaches always probably are paying attention to what they can get from each player and where he best fits in the big puzzle. And I think it's a lot with the horses too. I think you got to be very aware day by day of what is changing, what is not changing, what is working, what is not working. And then you can analyze maybe where you are. You try different things, and the next thing you know, boom, one of them's successful and so forth. And I think that my coaching background probably helped me the most there. The other thing is you talk about motivation. If I motivated anybody, it's probably those 8 or 10 guys that came up through our program.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up.
We motivated the hell out of them.
You think about some of those names, and you're thinking about names like Todd Pletcher and Dallas Stewart and Kieran McLaughlin and Mark Hennig. Those are prominent names in the sport. You have to be very proud of
Maker,
that.
Yeah, Mike Maker, yeah, goes right down. George Weaver, there's a bunch of them.
Yeah, that has to make you very proud.
Oh, yeah. That's our fraternity, and that I think if I have a legacy, the hell with all those horses that ran well. I think they were going to run well for almost anybody, but I think that being able to maybe give those guys a little boost and to work side by side and have that fellowship that we have and camaraderie with those other trainers is the thing that I'm proudest of.
I guess it would be similar to having one of your players go out and succeed at the next level, and you have that with guys like Todd and the names that we just mentioned.
Yeah, they're succeeding a little bit too much. They beat up on me every Saturday here.
Yeah, what's that like to lose a photo to one of your old pupils?
It happened a couple times here already. I ran a colt that I really like up here, and I looked up, and here come Todd. And no surprise there, of course. I'm really proud of what they have accomplished. And they were going to be good without me. I've often told people that if I gave them a little push, so be it. But I think that Todd and Karen and Dallas and those guys, they were good people. If I did do one thing right, I recruited really good guys. And they were going to be successful if they never heard of Wayne Lucas. Maybe I moved them along a little bit further, and I often wonder if they didn't help me more than I helped them. They were so damn good, and Jeff included, my son, they were so good that I just wonder that if I just faded into the sunset, if those horses wouldn't all have been champions anyhow. Hell, they were good.
Yeah. Well, your son obviously was an outstanding horseman, and all of those guys, you know, we've had all of them on this program, and they all credit Jeff with, you know, moving their careers along, and that's got to make you feel good as well. But, you know, I think they all have the same thing in common now with you in their work ethic and the way they run their stables. I mean, everything's first class all the way with those guys, and I think that comes from you directly.
Well, I hope so. Karen tells an interesting story one time. When I first hired Karen McLaughlin, by the way, I hired him and Letty, both his wife. You know, Letty was a hog walker, and Karen was a barn foreman, and I met him in Arlington, and I said, I would never pirate another man's help, but if you ever get to, you want to make a change, come and see me. Well, they did. Anyhow, the first day, I told Karen, I said, now, we get up here pretty early. I said, you probably could be here about 4 o'clock and wouldn't hurt, you know, and I just making a suggestion. So Karen's going to impress me. So he tells this story now. He's going to really impress me. He sets his alarm for 3 or something like that, and he gets up, and he thought, I'll be there sitting there when he gets there, and that'll really impress him. So he goes to the barn at 3:30, and he's marching down the shed row, and he opens the tack room door to the office. And I said, where you been? He said, I almost fell over.
That's great.
Talking with Hall of Fame trainer Dwayne Lucas here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Wayne, you used the word recruit when you talked about those other trainers that are now successful trainers on their own. How did you know that guys like Kieran and Todd and Dallas and Mark were going to be a good fit for your program?
Well, we visited a little bit, and, you know, not a real in-depth interview process probably, but I watched, you know, Todd was over, I think, a month or two with Charlie Whittingham, and I knew Todd's father very well. J.J. Pletcher and I have been friends way back, going back probably in early as maybe 1960. And so, you know, I kind of felt that in interviewing them or talking to them, that they were really, really solid people with a great work ethic. And then, of course, we bear down on them pretty hard right away. If they can last, it's kind of like the Marines maybe, or going to the West Point or some point, making that comparison. We bear down on them pretty hard the first 6 months. If they last the first 6 months, they're probably going to do pretty good. I had one young guy that I sent up to New York as a barn foreman, and after about a month or two, he called me up and he said, "Coach," he said, "I," He said, I don't think I'm cut out for this. He said, I'm a nervous wreck. He said, I wake up in the middle of the night staring at the ceiling. I can't sleep. I'm always afraid I didn't do everything right. And he said, I'm not sure I'm for this. I said, you're perfect. I said, you're doing just perfect.
Wayne, well, earlier you talked about the horses and the barn here and everything that you need basically being here right outside that door in your shed row. When your son passed away this past March, how much did you lean on the horses and on your profession and on your racetrack family to help pull you through?
Well, the racetrack family worldwide was so supportive and so understanding. And we found when there's we had adversity in the organization that the best thing to do is get right back in. You know, when Tabasco Cat ran over Jeff and we had that, we knew that that was very serious. We thought it wasn't at first, but then when he didn't come out of the coma, we knew that it was going to be serious. And Dr. Caton was so great and one of the very, very top neurosurgeons in the world telling us, you know, that we're in trouble. So we could have taken two different positions. We could have said, okay, everybody in the barn was down on Tabasco Cat. I mean, the grooms, the excise riders, everybody, understandably. I called them all in, and I said, no, we're going to go the other way. We're going to all of us pull together to make Tabasco Cat the best racehorse that we possibly can as a tribute to Jeff. I said, he didn't do anything that but run scared. The horse was not vicious. He was not tough, you know, to handle or anything. It just happened. So instead of that, we almost pulled it off. We got in trouble a little bit in the Kentucky Derby, but then we come back and got the Preakness and the Belmont. And every time he won, I thought that it made a statement about the barn and about Jeff too.
Yeah, it's I'll never forget that day. I was stabled down the road from you and. It was just a frightening thing for everybody, and the racetrack was on pins and needles for weeks. I mean, yeah. Everybody was thinking about Jeff, and you know, he was such a potent part of your organization. And I didn't really know him that well until after the accident, and we got to be friends, and we played golf several times, and I really enjoyed, you know, hanging around with him. He had such a great sense of humor, and took his lot in life with aplomb. I mean, he really embraced it and he couldn't be the same way he was before, but it didn't stop him, you know.
No, he had a great attitude about it right up to the end. Really, he had a great, and I say this fatherly pride, but he had a great feel for what horse fit where and what to do with them. It was a intuitive in a lot of ways, I'm sure, but he would read the condition book far better than I ever did. And I think Todd and Karen and all those guys would tell you the same thing. When the condition book would come out in New York, Mike Lakow was the racing secretary at the time, and he said he used to dread that phone call from Jeff because he said the phone would ring. It'd be out only about an hour. And he said the phone would ring, and Jeff would say, Mike, turn to page 16. You can't write the race that way. The weights are all wrong. Here's how you have to correct it. Now turn to page 27. The third race, this is incorrect. You have to change it. And Mike would tell me, he said it just drove him crazy because he'd be dead right. He said he'd go through and just flip through it and make all the corrections and then call him.
Well, you have a couple of grandkids that you're very proud of as well. Brady and Kelly, I believe. What do they think of Granddad being a Hall of Fame horse trainer?
Well, it's interesting because Kelly and Brady never knew Jeff as we knew him, you mm-hmm. know, before he got hurt. Brady was about four and maybe turning four when it happened, and Kelly was just months old. So they never knew their dad as, you know, we all knew him when he was very effective as a trainer. So they have kind of drifted towards me a lot, and, of course, I've tell them about their dad and relate the stories and everything, but they were never around the horses either. And now Brady, who is graduated from the Air Force Academy and played linebacker there and was a very good student there. He's doing very, very well. He's still in the Air Force, and he just this week was appointed to a very important position. He's going to be the mission coordinator for Air Force One.
Wow.
Every time Air Force One takes off now, he will coordinate the flights and the escort and everything. So it's a huge, huge honor. And
is he going to get his grandfather a trip on Air Force One?
Yeah, I don't know if I want to ride with either one of them. Let's not go there.
You know, you mentioned the name Tabasco Cat, and it brings to mind some of the owners that you've had the privilege to be associated with. And you think of William T. Young and Bob and Beverly Lewis, Eugene Klein, the list goes on and on. Reflect back on some of those owners, Wayne, and those relationships that you were able to build.
Well, the ownership that I was blessed to have is absolutely the foundation of every good thing that probably happened to us as a trainer in a race stable. I was blessed with really, really, really good people. And the Bill Youngs, the Bob Lewis's, the Gene Kleins, Bob Baker, Bill Mack, down through the years. I mean, gosh, we were just so blessed to have people that understood the game and loved the game. And I mentioned the other day, somebody asked me about winning the Kentucky Derby. And we've been fortunate enough to win it four times, as the record shows. The first time, I told them, the first time when we won it, I was caught up in the stable and me. I thought, man, we accomplished this wonderful thing, won Kentucky Derby, and I'm feeling pretty good about myself. It was interesting. When we won it the second, the third, and the fourth time, the minute they hit the line, my thoughts went to the owner. I thought, I've been there. I've had it. This is something for them now to enjoy. This is a great moment. And I immediately, you know, went to Michael Tabor and Demi O'Byrne when we won with Thunder Gulch. And then the most emotional I've ever been after a race is when I met Bill Young on the turf course going to the winner's circle after Grindstone won. I mean, my whole thoughts were to those guys, this is something we've done now for the people that made us where we're at today. And that was the most revealing thing, I think, about winning those big ones.
He's Hall of Fame trainer Dwayne Lucas. He is with us as our special guest tonight on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. We're going to step away for a short break. We'll come back with more, and we'll talk about his very first win in the Kentucky Derby with a filly by the name of Winning Colors. We'll do that next here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Make plans now to attend the Fasig Tipton Saratoga Sale, August 8th and 9th in Saratoga Springs, New York, with 252 selected yearlings by the world's leading sires. The Saratoga Sale produced four Eclipse champions in 2015, more than any other sale in the world.
American Foal is finally the one! American Foal has won the Triple Crown!
But there is absolutely no stopping Songbird. It is all Songbird, Mike Smith aboard, crushing the field.
Stella Wind and Victor Espinosa could not have been more impressive in the Santa Anita Oaks.
But Tippin has won the Breeders' Cup Mile.
And in stats recently released by the Blood Horse Market Watch, Saratoga was once again named the number one major North American yearling sale by percentage of Grade 1 winners, graded stakes winners, and stakes winners from horses sold. For more information, visit FasigTipton.com.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at BloomRacing.com.
Dedicated to the improvement of thoroughbred breeding and racing. A single promise that has never changed, but one that has evolved to meet the needs of equine athletes and their owners through continual innovation, commitment, and leadership.
From fan development to safety, from aftercare to cutting-edge technology, the Jockey Club has proudly served the thoroughbred industry since 1894. Visit jockeyclub.com for more information.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Russell Meyer, what a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
With the amazing purse structure and bonus program, everybody wants an outstanding New York bread, and the place to get one is Select Sales. The number two consignor in the country, Select Sales has sold 8 2016 graded steaks winners, including the great Teppan, Stonetastic, and Sharp Azteca. Grade 2 Amsterdam steaks winner Mind Your Biscuits is a Select Sale graduate, and this year's consignment features athletic and classy yearlings by sires like Uncle Mo, Take Charge Indy, Freud, and Mission Impossible. Everybody at Saratoga wants an outstanding New York bread. Your odds on to find one at Select Sales.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Winning colors in front. Here comes 49er on the outside. Lucas and Stevens. It's a driving finish. Winning colors by a head. Wire to wire with Gary Stevens in the iron. It was 49er on the outside coming from far back at the head of the stretch to narrow the gap and lose it by only a half length. Show, but Winning Colors, who defeated the boys in the Santa Anita Derby by grabbing the lead and never looking back, did the same thing in the 114th running of the Kentucky Derby, and she did it in 2:02 1/5 seconds.
Dave Johnson with the call of that 1988 Kentucky Derby. Winning Colors, the filly, getting the victory for Hall of Fame trainer Dwayne Lucas, who is our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton this evening. We do want to welcome everybody back joining us throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM 206, and listening worldwide on our website, horseracingradio.net. Don't forget, if you did miss any portion of this program, you can check out the podcast on our website, horseracingradio.net. Mike Penna, Jude Feld, Dwayne Lucas in the office here at his barn in Saratoga. Perfect setting to host this program. And JT, as we were going to the commercial break, we were talking about some of the owners that Wayne's been associated with. And you think about Winning Colors, certainly, with Eugene Klein. But you think about so many of the other greats that he's been associated with. It's incredible.
Yeah, well, I think, Wayne, you would change the face of trainers' relationships with owners. Before you... owners were treated like mushrooms, as Charlie Whittingham used to say, and we all know the rest of that line, which I can't use on the radio. But I mean, you actually showed respect to your clients and had relationships with them, close relationships, friendly relationships, that really worked. And I think that was a big turning point in our business.
Well, you know what? They were such quality people. They were so good. And what happens if you get a good relationship, and it isn't the success so much in the barn or what you've done with their horse, but if they're quality people and you reach out to them, and I learned so much from the Bob Lewis's and Bill Young's and so forth, obviously. They long afterwards become your best friends and close friends than they do clientele. You lose the clientele trainer relationship because you become a good friend. And we spent so much time together and enjoyed it. And the philosophy that Bill Young, for example, he'd call me in the evening and he would just say, Wayne, I don't have a lot on my mind. I just thought we'd visit a little bit. And then he would give me some business philosophy and talk about maybe some of the success he had and everything. And then he would say, Wayne, I'm getting tired now. I'm going to hang up. I love you. And hang up.
I mean, Does it get any better than that?
Yeah, no. That's priceless. That's priceless.
When you think back, you mentioned getting emotional with Grindstone when he won the Derby for William T. Young in 1997. But you think back on that first one with Winning Colors in 88. What goes through your mind when you look back on that day?
Well, the first thing, that happened is we came over from the quarter horses and we started getting some notoriety. We started winning a few races and so forth. And John Nayrud was kind enough to send us the horse Codex. So we go to the Preakness. First time I've ever went to Classics, you know, and this cowboy comes over there with, you know, Codex and the Preakness, and nobody took us too serious, although that horse had a pretty good prep set, you know, out there on the West Coast. And we win the Preakness. And first time ever. And I told Jeff, I said, hell, this is no big deal. I said, we're going to win a lot of these. I didn't realize it was going to take us 8 more years. But we win the Preakness. Then we run in the next year, we run in the Kentucky Derby, and we run third with just an average horse. And I thought, well, you know, this is overrated. This thing's not that tough. We're going to win some of these. And, of course, then we wait all those years until Winning Colors comes along, and we get the great one. And we were very confident on that one, really confident. When she beat the boys at Santa Anita so easily in the Santa Anita Derby, I thought we were in great shape. It was interesting because the day of the race, I'm looking in the paddock, and we're getting ready to leg the riders up. And, of course, the horses are circling. And I thought, hell, we got the biggest, strongest one in here. It doesn't matter what gender, that she's a filly. She's the best, biggest, strongest one in here. And I was standing there with Billy Reed, who was that time lead writer for Sports Illustrated. And he said, can I watch it with you? And I said, yeah. So we go down the tunnel. And it's just jammed on that little viewing stand. I didn't realize you get a box and go up there and la-di-da and everything. I just thought, hell, we'll go watch the race. And so Billy said, where are you going to watch it from? I said, duck in here. We ducked into a broom closet in the hallway and the tunnel there at Churchill Downs. It's about 8x10, smelled like Pledge. And there was a little bitty TV in the corner. And the janitor or guy, the custodian, was sitting in there, and he, of course, is watching, and Billy says to me, this is where we're going to watch it? And I said, yeah, this will be great. And he said, well, he said, what if she's not on the screen? I said, Billy, she's gray, and she's going to be on the lead every step of the way. I said, she's going to be the only one on the screen.
And there she was.
And she was on the screen all the way to the finish line that afternoon in 1988. Your next Derby win would be, well, quite a time later, in 1995. You had to wait for your second one with Thunder Gulch. Tell me about that day.
Yeah, we had a lot of Preaknesses and Belmonts in between there. But then Thunder Gulch was really, really a special little horse. And, you know, we got him just as he was turning three. And I remember Demi O'Byrne had me look at him, and I said, I don't know, there's nothing not to like. And so he bought him, and John Kimball had him, actually. I don't know who the ownership was, but... So they ship him out to Santa Anita, and I remember the morning he got there. He got there late in the afternoon. I didn't see him. So the next morning, Jeff comes walking down the shed row, and I said, did that little horse get in last night? And he says, yeah. And I said, where'd you put him? He said, well, he's down there in stall 12, but he said, I don't think he can see over the door. So he said, you better go down and look. And I said, well, he's not that small. But, you know, he had an unbelievable run to the Derby, and then afterwards, if you tried to do what we did with Thunder Gulch now, I think you'd get fired. You know, we went to the Fountain of Youth, the Florida Derby, the Bluegrass, the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness, the Belmont, the Haskell, the Travers. I mean, and we shipped out in between those and won the swaps. I mean, if you tried to do that now, they'd say, this guy's crazy. We got to get rid of him.
You know, you've never been shy about putting a good foundation under your young horses. Is that part of the approach that you've always had with training?
Yes, I think it is. We're not afraid. They're bred to run. And if we always thought if they're good, run them. If they're not, rest them. But we've always pushed out. And one of my favorite quotes is that we've made a living running where we don't belong. We've never been afraid to enter up. If a horse gets good, we'll probably enter up where most people would, you know, question whether even the ownership. When Commendable ran, for example, in the Belmont, Bob Lewis listened to your talk shows and stuff and everything, and of course they were very critical. And he called me, you know, on entry day, and he said, "Coach, are we really doing the right thing here?" And I said, yeah, we're going to be awful tough. I said, we can do something in this race that the rest can't do. And he said, well, you're driving the bus. That was his favorite comment. And so he let us. And I remember I didn't go to the breakfast draw with all the hoopla and everything. And I was standing out there on the tarp in front of Belmont, and Bobby Frankel came down, who had the even money favorite and aptitude. He comes down and he says, what the hell are you doing here? And I said, I come for the Belmont. He said, you entered a horse? And they'd already drawn it. And I said, yeah. He said, who? I said, Commendable. He said, oh, hell. You know how that turned out.
Yeah. Commendable, of course, getting the victory that day back in 1996. And one of the more memorable Belmont Stakes, at least that we've been a part of, JT, to be able to see Commendable do that. How did you know he was the right fit for that race?
Well, I told Pat Day, I said, here's the deal. I said, the race is lacking speed. And you're going to get on a cruising speed. You're going to lay second or third, or you're going to be right up there forwardly placed. And I said, what I want you to do at the 3/8 pole, I want you to open up about 2 to 3 lengths, make a little bit of a premature move. And I said, I want you to be at least 3 or 4 lengths in front at the quarter pole. And he said, do you think we can do that? I said, yeah, that'll be easy for you. And I said, here's the deal. Then, Pat, I said, ride like you stole him. And I said, ride hard, because aptitude will be coming. But aptitude has got to run the last quarter in 23 seconds, and he can't. He can't do it. And he'll be flying at you, but you're going to beat him. And that's exactly what happened, just like in Hollywood script.
That's great.
What would you consider to be Wayne Lucas's greatest training accomplishment?
Oh, that's tough. It's a lot easier to remember the ones that I think are the worst. I think developing Tabasco Cat would probably fall right into that category pretty much. He was, you know, high-strung and difficult to saddle, difficult to be handling and so forth. And then you throw in the accident with Jeff and everything. And I remember when he won the Belmont, Mac Miller, the Hall of Fame, great trainer, great friend, wrote a very, very profound letter to me about, he said, you know, he just said, I've seen it all, and I've never seen a training job better than that one. And so I think that might have been the one that probably would stand out. Some of them were so damn good, they run in spite of me.
Well, that happens to all trainers. But what about your favorite? Is there one horse particularly that you hold dear to your heart?
You know, Jude, I get asked that at clinics a lot. And it's kind of the last girl you dance with is the one you take home. But, you know, it's an era deal where you know, you're caught up in the one that in that particular era, that window of 3 or 4 years, and then you move on. You say, man, I like this one, and so forth. Land of Lucy obviously was so brilliant that it, you know, you go along in this game, and you hope that somewhere down the line you will be blessed with one that is just so special. Zenyatta, Rachel Alexander, Spectacular Bid, Slew, so forth. And when it happens, you think, gosh, it happened to me. I've got one like that. And she was that way. And yet, you know, I look back and Winning Colors, winning my first Derby. You know, some of these others were so special. Serena Song, Lady Secret, goes on now. We've had 26 world champions. So each one of them has a place in my heart. So it's very difficult to say which one I probably was the closest to. Mm-hmm.
Well, you have quite a selection to choose from, and then you get a guy like Art Sherman who all of a sudden gets California Chrome. He's, you know, about your age, and he waited his whole life. He finally got one. So, what's it like to have that many to choose from?
Well, the thing I regret the most, and I've said this in the last 4 or 5 years more than not. The thing I regret the most is through that run in those years of having those great horses, I didn't step back and say, you know, I've been so blessed that not everybody has a run like this. Not everybody has had this kind of success, and that I didn't enjoy it more. I got to the point in the 80s and 90s when we were running 5 and 6 stakes on a weekend, I got a little bit calloused, and I regret that. Dallas Stewart would call me up and say, we just won the stake at the sapling at
Monmouth,
and I'd say, oh, good, ship him over to Belmont. We'll run him into Champagne. You know, I mean, it was just business as usual. I wish I'd have soaked it up a little bit more. I wish I'd have spent more time with the Bill Youngs and the Bob Lewis's after the big races and so forth. That's the thing I regret the most.
You started the show talking about your house and the memorabilia that you have in your house. How often will you take the time to go and to really meander through all that memorabilia and maybe watch some race replays of some of the greats that you've trained? Will you do that often?
More lately, trying to keep my morale up. The thing about it is, a few years ago, the Derby Museum came to me, and they were having some fundraising problems and so forth. And so I suggested that we do a fundraiser. And what it was is, I got all my buddies that won the Kentucky Derby, and we had a sit down, just soft back furniture, and I emceed it, and we did a special experience with each one of the participants at the end. Well, mine was that they could come to the house and have a brunch at Thursday before the Kentucky Derby with 8 people or 10 people and just see that memorabilia. Well, that thing really took off, and it was such a treat to let even 10 or 12 people go through there. Now, they did an inventory. The Derby Museum is interested in, as I understand, doing something down the line. And there's over 1,200 trophies in there. Wow. So, it kind of, it's impressive. I don't say that boastfully. I say that modestly, that I've been so blessed. But there's one room of just grade ones. And so it's been a treat to share that with so many people. And now we've decided we have a party on Thursday night, and we get people in there, and they get a chance to see it and enjoy it and so forth.
That's fantastic. You know, a few years ago, you went through a little slump where you weren't winning any races. You were down on horses. What kept you going through that, back to now where you're sailing again? You got a lot of nice two-year-olds coming. How did you make that transition?
Well, I know the reason for it, and there is no quit in me. I don't even know how to spell it. The thing is, here's the deal. Your clientele are your key. It is not a horse business. It's a people business when you get right down to it. And when we lost Bob Lewis, when we lost Bill Young, and we lost Gene Klein, those people are hard to replace. Now, you know, Jude, that our strong suit was the yearling market. We could get in the yearling market. Anytime they let us get in the yearling market, we were tough. And we lost that wheelbase. We lost that financial backing to get into the yearling market. They let me get in the yearling market, and I say this, I hope modestly, we're tough. If they let us get in there, we're tough. Now, last couple of years, Will Horton comes along. We buy Will Take Charge Brandy, and we got some really pretty nice two-year-olds now. We're back in that yearling market. That's the key. And the slump part, I didn't worry too much about that. I thought it's just a matter of time till we get another one. And, of course, Will Take Charge and Brandy came along, and that's been great.
Visiting with Hall of Fame trainer Dwayne Lucas on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Wayne, what's the key to selecting the proper yearling for your program? And is it a specific yearling that fits your particular program?
Well, we've adjusted over the years. When I first came over from the quarter horses, we were a little bit sprint-minded. You know, we thought we bought horses that looked fast and were fast. Over the last, 20 years or so, we've been concentrate probably, everybody wants the Derby or the Classics, and we realize that's where they all want to be. They'll all tell you that, no, they just want to have some fun and win some races. That's not true. they want to win the Derby. So we've changed our eye a little bit and gone for a little bit different type horse. But we try to buy an athletic horse. We do not get blinded by the pedigrees. We want pedigree. If we get pedigree and the look we want, it's really difficult to pay for those kind or at least get a ticket on them. So, but we always lean towards the athletic look first.
Take us back to the day when you received the news that you were going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Well, it's special for anybody that it has that honor. That's the highest honor. One of the things, I don't know if our listening public even knows this, but I'm the only human being that's been inducted into the Quarter Horse Hall of Fame and the Thoroughbred Hall of Fame. And that, to me, really is special. I cherish that, and I don't say that boastfully, but I think it's special. And when we were finally put in the Hall of Fame, I thought we'd probably get in the Hall of Fame. We had a pretty good resume to put out there. But then when it actually happens, it kind of hits you. And the thing that made it so special is all of those guys, including Jeff, got up there and, you know, they let you pick who you want to present you. And usually somebody will pick their, you know, best friend or their agent or whatever. And it was really keen that all of my guys got up there together. And, of course, that made it really special because I wouldn't have got there without them anyhow. So they really should have printed up about or bronzed about 8 or 10 plaques. And everybody should have got one on a copy, you know.
Well, those guys are going to get theirs probably soon enough. But it is amazing the crew that you assembled and how much they helped you and how much you helped them. Those guys... They're irreplaceable, and as you mentioned before, that's probably your biggest legacy. You continue to teach even to this day.
Well, the coaching comes out once you've been a teacher. You know, it's difficult to not teach. I find myself stepping out of bounds a little bit because the coach comes out of me all the time. I'll tell you an incident. A prominent trainer, very prominent trainer. I won't mention his name, came to me here about a year ago or 2 years ago now, and he said, look, I'm having a lot of trouble with this filly at the gate. And he said, I know that's been your forte over the years with the quarter horses and everything. And he said, I said, look, I've been watching. I said, I saw what they did the last couple of days up there. And I said, we're going all the wrong direction here. And he said, well, would you mind riding up there and maybe, you know, coaching us through it a little bit? I said, okay, here's what we're going to do. And I outlined a program. Well, we went up there for 3-4 days. And he's a guy that, well, he's actually a Hall of Famer. And we got this filly. I said, okay, here's what we're doing wrong. First of all, we're turning her the wrong way. Secondly, she doesn't know how to lead. And we went through everything. And she ran her next race in a stake and just parked. And so... You have a tendency when you see things like that to you want to be a coach. I remember hitting some golf balls with Bill Parcells over here at Saratoga National. We were just on the driving range hitting some balls. He looks down, there's a 20-year-old kid. He didn't know him, he had no idea who he was. He's watching him, and he walks down and tells him what he's doing wrong with his swing. And he comes back, and I said, you couldn't help yourself, could you? I said, the coach just came out. I said, here's a perfect stranger. You couldn't help yourself. You had to go down there and correct him. And that's how we are as coaches. You know, it just, it's ingrained in you. You know, I see somebody trying to load a horse, and I know they're doing it wrong. I'm over there loading a horse.
You have a great relationship with fellow Hall of Famers, Bob Baffert, Nick Zito. We hear quite often that you're working together on certain horses or whatever it might be. Talk about those relationships and how that all works.
Well, yeah, with Bob, I told some people the other day, Bob left Churchill Downs, so Jill's horse, he left Jill's horse, so I started training Jill Baffert's horse. And so I won with him. And the press asked me, they said, what about this? I said, this is where my life has gone. Now I'm working for Bob.
That's right, because I was at the Phasing Tipton sale, and Bob walks up and he says to you, oh, there's my trainer. Yeah.
He also told me that she wasn't used to getting a bill. He said, what the hell was that all about? He sent her a bill. He said, she doesn't get bills. I said, oh, no. I have a great relationship with them and a great respect and admiration. Believe me, those guys are good. And we've been able to keep our friendship. We go back quite a ways, Bob and I, for example. And yet I look up at Oaklawn Park, you know, in those preparations for the Derby, and here he comes, and I think, oh, brother. But we I think, have mutual respect, and I really think he's outstanding in what he does. He doesn't do it like I do. He's not a 3 a.m. guy. You know, he's not going to get up. He does it different, but there's a lot of different ways to get to the winner's circle. And I respect him for what he does. I think he is a very astute, detailed person in a lot of ways. And I don't like it when he goes to the entry box. Not if I'm in there. But we get along good. And, you know, for a while there in the 80s and 90s, the press and some of your colleagues tried to make a rivalry out of Bob and I, because we were in the derbies, you know, together. We ran 1-2 on, you know, the year that War Emblem won, and I was a proud citizen, and, you know, I turned it around. I beat Cavalier and with Grindstone and, you know, like that.
Yep.
And they tried to make a rivalry. Well, we went along with that, and, you know, I'd take a little shot at him, he'd take a little shot at me, and then we'd go to dinner that night.
You know, some people, when you ask them, who's the greatest trainer you've ever seen, they're going to say Dwayne Lucas. So I'll ask you, Wayne, who's the greatest trainer that you've ever seen?
Boy, I don't know. That I don't think I could even answer that. I've been around the good ones. You know, it was interesting. When I came over from it, I'll tell you about some quality people that I've seen in my era. When I came over from the Quarter Horses, we had done really well in that industry, in that game. We had won a lot of races and had the best horses in the world. When I came over and set up at Santa Anita, there was a certain amount of jealousy and resentment, and especially with maybe the younger trainers. And I think they saw us as a threat, and rightly so. But there were three guys, actually four guys that I felt real comfortable about, because Laz Barrera, Charlie Winningham, Bob Wheeler, all Hall of Famers, and Willard Proctor. Those four guys from day one accepted me. They were not threatened. They were secure in their position. Charlie Winningham was really, really, really got to be a close friend. Laz and I became real close friends, and it was interesting that those guys were not intimidated or anything, and we did come at them. We started running pretty strong right out of the bat, and yet they were wonderful. And I've seen some young guys coming up here, and I make every effort every day to make sure that I don't show any animosity or jealousy, that I welcome them to the game.
Oh, Wayne, we can't thank you enough for spending an hour with us. It's hard to believe. It's really flown by. We've really enjoyed the visit, and can't thank you enough for sharing some of those stories. I feel like we could use another couple of hours here on the program tonight, but really appreciate it, and all the best moving forward.
Well, thank you. I hope there's one more big run in this here. We're going to go out there in a few minutes and look at those two-year-olds and get our hopes up and make one more big old run so we can do this one more time.
Sounds good.
Yeah, we'll have to visit after your next Kentucky Derby win, okay?
We'll
do part two. Wayne Lucas here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Like all of our guests who appear on the program, he's going to receive a gift courtesy of one of our sponsors. That's Flair Equine Nasal Strips. What a visit.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Everything that we had hoped for.
Don't forget, if you missed any portion of this program, head back to our website, horseracingradio.net, and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes to listen to the podcast at your leisure. For our producers, Lee Delapina, and for Michelle Penna, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk.